Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. My name is Katrine and I am your host. And today I have with me again my big brother, Jason. And we actually recorded several months ago because we're really slow. We recorded part one. And I think there will be three parts because we're just very narcissistic and we like to talk about ourselves. But actually we're telling the story of our father, which is important to our story. And then we're going to talk about Jason. And then also we'll go into my story because I've actually had people asking me to record my story for Mormon Expression Voices. So hopefully you will not be disappointed. So also Jason is here in Utah. We live in different states, so we're recording face to face this time. In our last episode with our father, we were actually recording on Skype, so it's kind of fun to be together. Will either make us laugh more or cry more. We'll see. So, hi, Jason.
Hi, Katrine.
Thanks for coming to Utah.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start. You had a deep, dark secret growing up. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about it. No one knew about it. Do you want to start when you started knowing about it?
Sure. I think I knew for a long time from a very early age, except I didn't really know that I knew. Now that I look back, I think about all the different things that I thought and how I felt and the way I acted, and it's really clear to me.
So wait, now you know you knew what you knew when you knew then?
Yes. I now know what I knew when I knew. Yes.
And what is that?
I'm gay.
Dun, dun, dun. And how old were you? Because, okay, growing up in our childhood, I know that you must not even have the vocabulary to even know what that was. Did you?
No. I didn't know. I knew I was different, but I didn't really have any idea what it meant or why I was the way I was. I knew that kids treated me differently, a lot differently than they treated other kids. And it took me a long time to realize why. I didn't know that I acted differently. And it took a long time for it to kind of dawn on me.
Yeah, but not only did they treat you differently, you were bullied.
Very much so. Yeah, it was tough. It was really hard. And I didn't... No one ever talked about bullying. No one even knew what bullying really was back then. And so I just kept it all to myself.
Yeah, I really didn't know much about it. Every once in a while I'd hear a little something, but nowadays that would not buy. People would give the attention it deserved and stop it. And
yeah, I think so. I like to think so.
Yeah, hope so.
If I had known, if anyone had ever said, if someone is bothering you, come and tell us. I know I would have. I would have gone. I was just, I think, dying for somebody to say something to me about it, about how they noticed that I was being treated this way or that way, but no one ever said anything to me. So I just kept it in.
And how young did all that start?
I think it started, I started noticing it, I think, when the other kids started noticing it. I was like second, third grade is when I started getting called names and treated poorly and that kind of thing.
Okay. When did you realize that you were gay, that there was a word for it?
I don't remember the exact moment when I heard the word gay and knew what it meant and knew that that's what I was, but I think it's the meaning of the word gay slowly like dawned on me. And then probably in church is when I heard, or read about it specifically. Then it was in high school when I totally realized, oh, yep, that's it. That's exactly what it is. But of course I kept it all inside and I tried to deny it all because it was wrong.
And you hit it very well, I must say.
Well,
at least
depends
to
on
me.
Who you talk to.
To me, I had no clue. No idea. But you weren't just the typical high school student. You had responsibilities.
I did. Yes, I was in 12th grade. I was the seminary council president here in Utah, which back then, at least in my mind, it was a really, really big calling, and it was a very important responsibility. And I was very, very proud of that, and I got a lot of my identity from it. And so, of course, I didn't want to.
Well, and you were good at it.
I think I was. I don't know.
And plus, Utah Valley, back in that time, if you were a seminary teacher, you were basically the prophet of the high school, is about what it compares to.
A seminary council president?
Yes.
Yes.
What did I say?
Well, you said seminary teacher.
Oh, seminary council president. Sorry.
Prophet of the high school? I don't know. But it was kind of like in my mind and the minds of some other kids, I was the equivalent of like the student body president, only for the spiritual side, the seminary side. So
I'm trying to think about what I want to ask you. I could learn so much from this interview. Should we talk about Olivia Newton-John?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, that was one of the, now that I look back, that was like one of the clues, was like my taste in music and the things that I liked to do and the things that I did not like to do. And a lot of it too was just the way I acted. I realized at a certain age, I think it was in junior high, I realized that, oh, well, they're calling me a sissy. They're calling me a fag. They're calling me a homo. People didn't really say gay really in junior high.
Mostly fag. Mostly, yeah.
But that's when I realized, okay, well, there must be a reason why they're saying this to me. And so I took a really good look at myself and realized, oh, yeah, I am effeminate in a lot of ways. So that's when I realized that if I wanted the way I was being treated to stop, that I needed to change my behavior. And so I made a very conscious effort to kind of just to turn my personality off. Especially when I was kind of out in big groups where, I didn't know everybody well. And I just tried to make my personality flat.
Well, that came at a cost too. That affected your eating and your emotional well-being, even though you were flat. It showed up in other ways physically.
It did. I think that was part of stifling myself. And also I was just so terrified of everything that the church told me about being homosexual and having same-sex feelings and all of those thoughts. It terrified me so much that it all came out in physical ways instead of coming out naturally in my personality or in my actions. It came out in other ways. And mm-hmm. One of those ways was just like a huge, huge, huge insecurity around other guys. I always felt really comfortable with girls, but when I was around other guys, especially those that I found to be really interesting or sure, attractive, or even just like ones that I really wanted to be just friends with, that's when I would start to feel like I'd have anxiety attacks and I'd feel sweaty and my mind would race and then I would eventually feel nauseated and a lot of times I would throw up because of those feelings. And that went on for a few years actually. So in a way, I guess I sort of developed an eating disorder. It was related to my self-image, but it wasn't that I wanted to be skinny.
Well, you weren't forcing yourself to throw up. Literally could not keep it down.
No, I never forced myself to throw up, and I didn't tell myself that I didn't want to eat. But I would. That would be the result, is that I wouldn't eat because I couldn't eat, or when I did, when these circumstances would come up, then I would throw up. So.
And then you also became thin, and then you were self-conscious eating around people because you thought people were looking at what you're eating.
Really thin, yeah. And I did. I was self-conscious about that. I didn't like the idea of eating in front of other people because I was afraid that I would get really nervous again about it. And I was afraid that like somebody would be there that that I've, in my mind, I really liked or esteemed or wanted to be friends with, or maybe had a secret unconscious crush on. So I didn't like, I didn't want to eat in front of people either. And it just kind of, it was just like a cycle because I would be so thin and then people would say things and I would feel self-conscious and then people would come around that I, you know, it just went, it was just a vicious cycle that I didn't, I felt a lot of despair and I didn't feel like I would really ever, I didn't know how I was going to get out of it. There's a lot of anxiety involved. And then it didn't help that I became a really, really best friends with this great guy who did a lot for my, for me socially. And I, because of him, I had a, I gained a really nice close knit group of friends that, that really loved me and accepted me the way that I, well, the way that they saw me. And that was all great, but I felt like he was so important to me that I started, I think, to fall in love with him and I wanted to be with him all the time. And then, you know, looking back, I had fallen in love with him, I think. And I, it was all I could think about, but I wasn't supposed to think about it.
And he,
and, and it was wrong. And so that he made me feel even more anxiety.
Well, and he's so, heterosexual.
Yes. So. And he was heterosexual. So, of course, there was no reciprocating in that way, but he was a great friend to me. And he, I was always thinking like, oh, well, he said that. So we're really close friends. And he said that. So that must mean that, wow, he really likes me. But,
awkward.
No, it was a mess. Could have all been avoided.
I'm 5 years younger than Jason, so I really looked up to him, still do. But he, to me, was a spiritual giant. And he always had pictures of Christ up. He had Mormon ads in his room, read his scriptures daily. He would go lay out on the lawn chair reading his Book of Mormon while he got his tan. Just, you know, you really put a lot of time and effort into your spirituality.
I did.
How much did that have to do with kind of a cleansing your conscience for the feelings you were having, or if at all?
I don't know if I was trying to cleanse my conscience, but I really wanted to do what I was supposed to do. And I, you know, I was totally, I was a real true believer, and I wanted to do what I thought I was supposed to do. I wanted to obey and I wanted to obtain all those blessings and promises that, that you're told that you will get if you do. So, you know, in my mind, I hoped too that I would be able to just, I was always in denial. I was hoping I would just, it would just go away. I would once and for all be able to put this temptation behind me and these thoughts behind me and this whole persona of who I was behind me. So I think that's why I really went into this, the spiritual side of things, because I felt like that felt safe to me, because I knew I felt like I was doing the right thing. So I kind of maybe went, I know I went to an extreme with it. Which I guess in those days are when you're taught about living your life the right way. There didn't seem to me to be an extreme, like an extreme Mormon. I thought the more obedient you were, the better. The more you tried, the harder you did, the harder you worked. That was all better. And then of course there's always the folly of self-righteousness and judgment. And so I felt like I was trying so hard and I was being so good, and being so extreme about all these things that I felt like that in a way I felt like I was better than a lot of people that I was around. And so that was not healthy. That was not good. And all the while I was fighting these huge demons deep down inside of me, but not, not totally consciously most of the time.
Let us talk about how the priesthood approached homosexuality. I don't know if you want to talk specifically about Elder Packer's talk, about anything he said, or just anything in general that affect you in church when they would talk about it.
Yeah, I was riveted every word that was ever said about same-sex attraction or masturbation or the law of chastity or anything that had to do with that. I was like, I would hang on every word and I would read voraciously everything I could find on the subject. And of course, Elder Packer's famous little factory talk was right up there.
Because how old were you at that time?
I was probably 13 or 14.
I didn't know you were that young.
Yeah. And then, of course, the miracle of forgiveness had a big, huge part of that,
which he asked me to give him before he went on his mission. So I bought it for him. I was all proud to give him this book that he needed for his mission. And then it was only a year ago that I found out what that book was even about. And I was horrified that I had given you this book.
That's funny. I don't remember that.
You don't?
I don't remember asking you for that.
You asked me to give it to you. I did. And, oh, I think I apologized to you even.
Yeah, I do remember that.
I'm like, I gave that to you. Yep. Anyway, well, that miracle of forgiveness book kind of brings you to your mission.
Mm-hmm.
You were a good Mormon boy, first boy out of five brothers. You know, you had to set that example.
Mm-hmm.
You were elect and chosen.
Yes.
So you went in and you got your mission call.
I did. Right after, we mentioned earlier, right after I realized that the second coming was not happening.
Oh, wait. Before Christ comes, yes. We need to talk about your first kiss in high school.
Oh, my first kiss. Yes. Well, that's another point of anxiety that I had is I felt so much pressure to have a girlfriend or to like a girl because everybody else around me seemed to like someone or they were starting to have girlfriends. My best friend had a girlfriend.
Which all the time.
Me to
the
no
three of
end.
You in the truck and the cab.
So I really wanted a girlfriend. So there's this one girl who was kind of in our circle of friends. She's very, very quiet and, I convinced myself that I kind of liked her and I heard maybe that she maybe kind of liked me.
And she was very pretty. It wouldn't be hard for any guy to like her.
She
really.
Was pretty and she was sweet and, a wonderful girl, really. Super shy though. And we went out. I asked her to one of the school dances and then I dropped her off in the big blue station wagon. Which was another source of anxiety in my life. And
come on.
That and the green truck.
Had oodles of personality.
Yes. So anyway, I walked her to the door like every good teenage boy should. And I asked her if I could give her a kiss. And she said yes. And I kissed her just very quickly on the lips. And I said goodnight and walked away. And I thought it really stuck with me about how boring that kiss was and how I told everybody it felt like I was kissing the back of my hand.
Yes. You told me that. And I thought, well, why did you kiss her?
I guess I expected fireworks or something. And of course she didn't, maybe if she had responded in some way, but she didn't because she was so shy and maybe that would have changed everything.
Oh, it was her fault.
Yeah, it's all her fault. So, but that was just, you know, another of 1,000 pieces of the puzzle.
So you got your first kiss. Then the second coming didn't come. So you might as well go serve the Lord.
Right.
Got your mission call. And where did you go?
I went to Peru. It was fantastic. It was a wonderful experience. I'm glad I went. Again, this deep anxiety followed me into the MTC. And of course, I'm surrounded by all these guys 24/7. And there were a couple of them that I started to like get really close to spiritually. We connected spiritually. We connected like just as friends and confided in each other and things. And
well, you know what Dad would call that?
What's that?
Your spiritual spouse.
Oh.
If Dad can have spiritual wives, why can't you have spiritual husbands?
Well, I didn't think of that at the time, but if I could only go back. So I got really close to a few of the other elders in the MTC, and all that anxiety came back, and I started throwing up again. I couldn't eat, and I would get really, really weak, of course, from not eating. And then I couldn't study, and I couldn't do anything that the MTC requires. And it just got to be terrible. And I think part of it was anxiety of just going on a mission caused me anxiety. And then being with all of these other elders that I really esteemed and appreciated and that helped me out a lot, that kind of brought all that eating stuff back.
It got so severe. I remember they were talking about sending you home.
Yes, that came up. And that was like the worst nightmare I could ever imagine, was being sent home. That was the last thing I wanted. I would have, you know, had to have been hospitalized before I would have said okay to that. And so I was really worried that that's what would happen, because of course that's the biggest disappointment ever in Mormonism and in Utah Valley, and especially back in the 80s, I think it was even more than now. It seems like the pressure has kind of...
A little bit. There's still a lot, but not like that. Then.
And they're a lot choosier. I mean, if there is... I understand if there is someone of missionary age who is having issues like that anyway, then they might not necessarily want them to go. It's, you know...
And they send them home quicker now if there is a problem.
If there is something, yeah. Yeah. So I ended up seeing, I finally confided in one of my MTC teachers, a sister teacher, female teacher, who was wonderful, loved her so much. And I confided in her, and she was able to talk to some people, and I started getting... I was able to go to a few sessions with a psychologist or therapist or a psychiatrist, probably eventually had to be a psychiatrist there at BYU. And he prescribed a medication that was now, I didn't realize back then exactly what it was, but it was really just a tranquilizer. So he prescribed tranquilizers for me, and it did what it was supposed to do. It relaxed me enough that I was able to eat. That was like first and foremost in my mind. So I didn't panic. I didn't have those anxiety attacks anymore. I was able to eat, and so I was also able to function in the MTC. But it made me very, very, very drowsy too. While I was doing all these things, I was just like constantly falling asleep. So that was a battle that I had to fight. But I was much happier to fight that battle than the other one. So anyway.
What, did you tell that therapist or anyone else about your same-sex attraction?
No, not while I was in the MTC.
Did you ever tell anyone?
No, I actually did. Actually, in high school, backtracking a bit, in high school I did tell mom and dad.
You did?
I did. Not that I had same-sex attraction, but I told them that I was having this anxiety, and mainly that I was just throwing up all the time and I couldn't eat, and it was related primarily to my best friend.
Oh, okay.
So I kind of had to beg for some help. Surprise. Did that surprise you?
We begged a lot as children.
I had to beg for some kind of intervention. So what did they do for me? Well, they sent me to the bishop.
I didn't know you had gone to the bishop. And you told him about it?
Not about my same-sex attraction.
Okay.
about my anxiety. I was just overwrought with this anxiety and the eating issues. So he referred me to LDS Social Services.
Oh, I'm actually relieved, actually, because most of the time, especially back then, bishops just
would just say,
pray some more.
Yeah, pray some more. Yeah. Well, he kind of did that too.
Okay.
But at the same time, I went to LDS Social Services, and I remember the therapist not addressing homosexuality head on, but just kind of skirting it a little bit and saying, well, when you have these feelings when you're with your friend, why don't you try thinking of something else?
Why don't you sing a hymn?
Well, like he almost said that, but he might as well have, but he said to me, well, to not think about this, why don't you just practice this? Turn on the radio and just when you're at home on your own, turn on the radio and try not to listen to it. Just do everything you can to not listen to the radio and tune it out. And supposedly that was supposed to carry over into my life. And so when I was having these anxiety feelings, I was supposed to be able to just tune out the anxiety and be better.
All right. I know enough about anxiety that if you try to tune it out, it gets worse and worse.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to deal with it. So, and then that didn't work so well. Then actually I do remember going to a private therapist of some sort, psychologist, and for a couple of sessions, and we did actually get to what we figured was the bottom of the issue. And he was right.
Did you just tell him or did he ask you directly?
He kind of had to drag it out of me, I think. I didn't want to go there at all.
Was there any feeling of relief or horror?
Well, I felt a little relieved because I thought, oh, good. Now I'm going to feel better. Uh-huh. But I didn't because of course I was still trying to shove everything down and not admit to it and not be gay. So then anyway, you want to fast forward to my mission again?
Yeah. So they put you on tranquilizers.
So I'm on tranquilizers and they helped a lot. And I figured they were a godsend, which, you know, I think they were, but.
And then they sent you to a third world country.
And they sent me to a third world country and there was no promise that I would be able to get that medication while in Peru. But I wanted to do the right thing so badly. I wanted to do this mission so badly that I was willing to just say, okay, well, hopefully it'll work out. I went and I actually felt a lot of the same anxiety problems, but with the tranquilizers, I was able to deal with it and had a wonderful mission. And I remember at some point, I was actually able to kind of wean myself off of them for a while. Because I had felt, I got to a comfortable place where I felt confident enough and my sexuality wasn't forefront in my mind anymore. So it didn't bother me so much. I felt a lot more confident.
From what I understand, being on a mission is a great place to be if you're hiding your sexuality. Because you can't date anyway. No, you can't have those feelings.
No, you can't.
Your little factory's shut down.
Yeah, well, hopefully that's what the intent is, you know, to shut it down. But even though I had a great mission, there were still things that like came up. Like, I had a couple of missionary companions that I was really close to and I could feel myself feeling attracted to them. And then one of them, it didn't help that one time on RP day, he decided he was going to lay out in the sun in a little tiny Speedo. That was not helpful. But I got past it. Okay. So I feel like I had a successful mission.
You baptized a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, it was South America in the '80s.
Yes. You were a zone leader.
I was. Yeah. I made it a zone leader. I was kind of disappointed that the mission president didn't want me to be his assistant, but you know, whatever.
Not everyone understood your importance.
I know. I was used to being kind of, you know, the spiritual king.
Hey, I was seminary teacher.
I'm seminary council president.
Didn't you know?
Yeah. But funny thing about him is that when he met me, I chuckle about this when I think about it. He met me for the first time and we chatted for a little while and he goes, and this was all in Spanish because he was a native Peruvian. And he's, after a while, he said, "Are you British?"
I got that in Texas.
Oh, you did?
I would like go to the class to read to little elementary school students. And a couple times the teachers would be like, "Are you from England?" I'm from Western Utah.
Yeah. Well, I just thought that he said that to me later. I like, cause you know how they stereotype British guys and say that they're all fancy.
Oh, really?
And fancy and effeminate and whatever. But at the time, it didn't cross my mind.
Did you drink your pinky up?
I probably did. Yeah. I probably drank my tea
with
my
sachet.
Pinky. No, actually, I was still trying to stifle things. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Apparently, you weren't very good at it. If they think you're British.
Yeah. My mission president thought I was British. So, either you're British or you're gay. I'm not going to ask if you're gay.
Okay. But I remember your letters and you enjoyed your mission. You had a good time for the most part.
I did. I was really fully into it.
The toilet paper enraged you.
There were little things that enraged me. The toilet paper was more like crepe paper. And you couldn't flush it down the toilet. It all had to go in the wastebasket next to the toilet, of course. But the toilets usually didn't flush anyway. And then, of course, the fact that most of the Peruvian elders just used the church news to wipe their butts instead of actual toilet paper really chapped my hide.
They're wiping with the word of the Lord.
Yeah, and they're missionaries wiping their ass with the church news. I was wrong. I never did that.
Never.
Never. Imagine. Maybe now I'd feel differently about it, but wiping your ass with the face of Ezra Taft Benson.
Now you'd volunteer.
No, not even.
No, his hiney's too precious for that. Yeah. He needs soft Charmin.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I was proud of you. You went on your mission. You were the good big brother. Your letters were the highlight of my week. We were all proud of you. And you came home, and I remember following you around like a little lost puppy dog, because I was so glad you were home. Mm.
I was glad to be home.
Which is a lot to say, considering our home.
I know. And the thing that hit me the most when I got back was sitting in our house, looking around it. It felt like the lap of luxury. Whereas growing up, especially in high school, I was like, oh, this place is in such serious disrepair, such a mess. And it was all I could do to get out of there. But when I got back from my mission, it really hit me how good we had it compared mm-hmm. to what life is like for so many other people in the world.
Then you came home and for a while you talked about being a lawyer, but then you decided you wanted to go into education.
Right.
So you headed up to Utah State.
Mm-hmm. I loved it there.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a really a love-hate relationship with Logan, Utah State. Loved the school though.
I followed you up to Utah State and every once in a while I would see you on campus.
Yeah.
And you were always surrounded by girls. Always. And we're not talking like one or two girls. We're talking 6 to 10 girls at all times.
Oh, funny. Yeah. Well, it is elementary education and it's still that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
You definitely had the friends that were girls.
Always that. Yeah, that's what felt natural.
But shortly after that, you reconnected with a girl you went to high school with.
Yes. Yeah.
A wonderful person.
Yes. And we had been really close friends since junior high, actually. We were really close in high school. And we had our ups and downs, but for the most part, we were close, and then she got married right out of high school, and then I went to Utah State, and then I went on my mission, and while I was on my mission, she had gotten divorced, and she had a child, a little girl, and she had moved back home with her parents. So she was back home with her parents just prior to me returning back home with my parents. So we reconnected. She knew I was home, and I knew she was there, and so we rekindled our friendship. It was nice, and I instantly fell in love with her little girl, and our relationship very quickly evolved into a romantic one, which completely blew me away.
That was possible?
That it was even possible. And so there were a lot of things that made me want to be in that relationship, but the fact that it was her and that she found me attractive and that she wanted to be with me was really reinforcing to my idea of, oh, well, maybe I can get over this. Because I still, you know, I still had in the back of my mind all the time that maybe I would never get over my homosexual feelings. So I thought she was definitely going to be able to help me get over that. So, but that's not the only reason that I married her. I was trying to do the right thing.
And you were really good friends.
And we were really good friends. And I did love her. I loved her very much. So we got married really quickly. I got home in April for my mission, and we were married in December.
As every missionary should be.
Yes. I was doing the right thing.
Now, what I find interesting, because she had just recently been divorced, so she hadn't had a temple cancellation.
Right.
Yet you two were still able to go to the Logan Temple and be married.
Right.
Just for time.
Right.
But I have never actually even met anyone or heard of anyone else doing this. How was that possible for you?
I don't know if they still do it, but if there is a couple in that situation who is worthy and wants to get married in the temple, because it's the temple, but is not, because of the pending sealing cancellation, are not able to be sealed, then they do allow, or they did allow, couples to get married for time only.
Hmm.
And until the sealing cancellation goes through. And then once that went through, we were sealed.
Now, tell about your experience getting married for time in the temple.
Well, we were in the temple waiting for our turn to go into the sealing room. And I think we were sitting on a bench out in the hallway or something. And a phone rang, and one of the temple workers answered it. And she's like, "What's that? Time only? For time only." "All right. Brother Christensen, this one's for time only." Like, she was yelling that down the temple hall. It felt like she was yelling it. Maybe we were just both so, like, horrified. And so he was like, "Okay, all right, time only, all right." And so I felt like saying, "Well, we're sitting right here." But, you know, no one said anything.
I'm still worthy.
I know. So, but we chuckled about it. We thought it was funny. And then we were, during the ceremony, the part where the officiator says, I don't remember the exact words, but I now pronounce you married.
We know those aren't the words.
Instead of saying whatever he said. You are now married. Instead of saying you are now married for time and all eternity, he goes, "And you are now married for time and all time." Because he was so used to saying that phrase of time and all eternity. So we thought that was funny.
You're married for time and all time.
Time and all time.
I wonder what would happen if he hadn't caught himself.
Ooh,
and you'd been sealed.
Do you think?
What would have happened?
Like, accidentally been sealed?
Oop. Your ex-wife would have been married to two men.
Two men at the same time?
Can you imagine?
No way. Impossible.
No,
that wouldn't have happened.
No, no, no,
that
no.
That would have just voided itself, I'm sure.
I'm pretty sure whoever's in that temple would have, like, self-combusted or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're married for time and all time.
Yeah. Yes.
And you actually had a lovely reception In the cultural hall.
Yep, in the cultural hall.
But it was pretty. It was Christmas pretty. Time.
Yes. We paid for it ourselves.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And you lived happily ever after.
Mm-hmm. For a little while. For a very short little while. Well, not really.
When did the homosexual feelings come up during your marriage? Did it? I mean, I don't know how this works. Was it a problem the whole time or?
No, I was so into being married and so glad that I was finally fixed. I think I really did consider myself better, like all better, fixed. And so, although the honeymoon was a bit of a disaster, no, it was a huge disaster, let's face it. We were able to work together to consummate the marriage and at least have a physical relationship to a degree.
Well, your whole married or just the first night?
No, we probably for a good year, we had a pretty, in my mind, I guess it was pretty normal and decent. I don't think she really, I'm sure she looking back was always wanting more. And I didn't yet address that in my mind. I just felt like it was just, you know, it's just we just need to work on this as part of our relationship, our marriage relationship.
You did get pregnant. Your wife
got
pregnant.
We did, yes. And we very much wanted to have a baby and to add to our little family and give our daughter a little brother or sister. And so we tried. We put a lot of effort into it and we did conceive and we had a little girl. And that was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. And I'd always wanted to be a parent and I always wanted to be a dad. So that was wonderful. And well, actually, though backtracking a little bit, about the time that my ex became pregnant was when I started to have like a huge influx of same-sex thoughts and attraction. And it started to become an obsession. It just got worse and worse during the pregnancy. And of course, it's normal for, I think, couples who are expecting for their sex life to taper, probably, I imagine. And ours definitely did. And it pretty much came almost to a stop, which I thought was normal, but at the same time I was having more and more of these feelings. And all the time I was struggling though, really hard with it. I was battling it, fighting it so much because I thought I was fixed, but here these thoughts are coming again. And, so then when my daughter was finally born, then it was such a moving experience, such a spiritual, life-changing, beautiful experience to have that little girl that I thought then I was fixed. I was like, oh, then certainly, how could I possibly ever, now that I have her, could I ever have another thought that would jeopardize my eternal future with this amazing little person? And so I thought that had fixed me finally, because how could I possibly be so horrible to do that? And of course, I worked for a little while, but then the thoughts just came plowing through again. And then it just became more and more and more. I graduated and, we moved out of state and, started working and it became just like almost uncontrollable. I didn't ever act on any of those things, but it was just this, it was a huge obsession. So then I still hadn't told anybody about it. So then, well, I'll say this, that we moved to Southern California and that was in 1994 and we lived in Los Angeles area and there was the Northridge earthquake and our home was red tagged and we were just freaked out and just didn't know what to do. And we had no money and, So in our haste, we made the decision that my ex and the girls would move back to Utah because we didn't know where to go, didn't know what to do. We didn't think there was anywhere to live.
Well, you were literally sleeping in the park.
And we slept in the park for two nights before we came back home to Utah. So, you know, we were just so young and so poor and we just didn't know what to do. So my ex and the girls came back to Utah and I stayed there to continue working. I rented a room from some friends and that's when it really, really intensified because my family wasn't there anymore. I had a lot of free time on my hands. So I just kind of let my mind go and explore things more deeply. Again, I never acted on them other than looking at some porn, but that was even like that to me, that was acting on it. That was mind blowing, then going through all that and realizing that, oh, that this is, it kind of explained a lot to me about why I felt the way I did and why things were that they were the way they were with my wife. And it just kind of all fit together. Even so, I was still horrified that that was the truth. So, and then at that point, I felt like it had come to such a head that I felt like I really needed to talk to my bishop about it. So I talked to my bishop. At that point, I didn't tell him about homosexual thoughts at first. First, I said that I had been looking at pornography. And then he kind of asked me more and more questions, and I was trying to skirt it, and I was trying to avoid it at all costs, because I just wanted forgiveness for the pornography. I didn't feel like I needed forgiveness for my homosexual thoughts because I hadn't done anything other than a whole lot of masturbation.
Oh, I'm a sister.
I know, my sister likes to hear this, huh? Sorry, sis. And so, a few years ago, I could have never said that to you.
A few years ago.
Like last year. And,
it's true. I was a prude.
Oh yeah.
Oh man.
So in this conversation with my bishop, he got out of me what kind of pornography I was looking at. I couldn't hide it anymore. I couldn't hold back. And I just said, yeah, I mostly was looking at the male pornography. And he said, well, here's what we need to do. We need to get your wife back here. We've got to get your wife back here. And then you've got to continue working as a family towards your eternal progression and going to church together and doing all those things.
Did he want you to tell your wife?
He said, no, don't tell her. I asked, I said, should I? Do I need to confess this to her? Do I need to tell her about it? He said, no, it's better if you don't tell her. So I didn't, not for maybe 6 months. They came back and we bought a condo and we settled in. And
it was beautiful.
It was beautiful. You know, it may have been more than 6 months. It may have been a year and 6 months. I can't remember the exact timeline anymore right now, but I went for a while without saying anything to her. And I went for a while without thinking about it much anymore because I was just so relieved to have my family back and I didn't want to, again, jeopardize our eternal salvation and all of that. So, but then slowly and eventually it came back again. The thoughts came back and then, at one point we had gotten in a big argument about something and I can't remember what it was. I think it had something to do, must have had something to do with the church or my spirituality, the way I was leading the family or something about that I wasn't doing the right way. And so I just was so frustrated and I had so much anxiety from having pent this all up that I wrote her a long letter and I told her what had been going on, except I still didn't say the same sex part. I said that while you were gone, I was looking at a lot of porn and I've been having all these thoughts and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sorry that I haven't been the good husband that I need to be. And I'm going to try harder and I'm going to work harder. And she read the whole thing. And then, and I actually was sitting there with her when she read it. And she looked at me and she goes, "What kind of porn?" And that's when it came out. That's when I said, well, guys, it was guys. It's male porn, gay porn. And then she said, well, are you gay? And I said, well, I guess, but I can change that. I mean, I'm working on it. I want to try. I don't want to give up on us. I can overcome this. I can do it. And from that moment on, she never looked at me the same again. And you can't blame her. It had to have been awful for her. I know it was. It was terrible. So eventually, she realized first that it wasn't going to work. So after a while, we came to the agreement that we needed to change things. And so, you know, we promised to always be friends. And we still talked a lot and shared a lot with each other. And we always promised to work together to raise our girls. So we kind of, we went our separate ways emotionally and physically. And so that was what needed to happen.
And eventually you were divorced.
We did. We were divorced. We still continued to raise our daughters together. We had joint custody and we spoke all the time. We lived very close in proximity to each other.
I think you confessed to everyone else, like you told us, before your divorce, right?
Yeah.
Remember, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He sent a letter to everyone in the mail. There was no email.
Right.
Sent a letter.
My ex and I were getting a divorce.
And which was shocking because they really were close. You were really close with her and you were really good friends. So yes. It was a shock. Nobody saw it coming. And then you said, I'm homosexual is how you phrased it.
Mm-hmm.
That was a shock. Mm. No clue. No clue at all. And
nobody. No one in our family.
No one. I know everybody else seemed to know, but he didn't. And you even said to me at one point, you're like, you never saw any signs? I'm like, even looking back now, I really never saw any signs.
You just didn't know what to look for.
I didn't know what to look for. And even like, you would sew Barbie doll clothes.
Hello.
Like Barbies.
In seventh grade. I spent my summer between sixth and seventh grade sewing Barbie clothes for my sister.
And that should have been a sign, but really, I'm still this way where I'm just like, oh, if he wants to do it, I don't, whatever, you know, I don't care.
But I love to do your hair.
Yeah. But, yeah, you were better at sewing Barbie clothes than my hair. But even then you would say, now don't tell anyone I did this. Don't tell anyone I sold these clothes for your dolls. Don't tell anyone. I'm like, okay.
I knew it was the wrong thing to do.
And I was like, all right, if you don't want anyone to know, I don't care. I have some nice clothes for my dolls. I, you know. So even that was not a sign for me. I know I'm just not. Very aware.
So naive. Oh, but it was the 80s.
And it was in Utah Valley. Uh-huh. And we didn't get the little factory talk in Young Women's.
No.
But so it was just mind-blowing. And I never questioned. It was never a thought that you weren't a good person or that you wouldn't make it to heaven, or it was just never a thought. And I know that that's not what the church taught, but the two differences of the person I know you are and what the church taught just did not mesh. It couldn't mesh. And I also was really good at saying, well, when we die, we'll know when, you know, someday we'll understand. But
you would say things like, well, we're family.
That was
my primary worry when I came out was, what are the people that I'm close to going to say and think of me? I really had this horrible thought in my head that all my brothers and my sister would just think, oh, well, you know, just go along with the church's explanation of all of it. Oh, well, he's no longer going to be with us and he's going to the celestial kingdom and I can hate the sin and love the sinner, but he's gone.
Well, and that's my thought process, but I didn't realize for years that I had never really expressed that to you until one day you had a blog and you wrote that I guess my family thinks that I'm going to hell. Mm. And I was just shocked that you thought that you thought I thought you were, you know, going.
Yeah. I spent all those years thinking that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was surprised you thought that. And then I was like, well, of course he did. I never told him.
Right.
I felt awful. I really felt awful about that because I just guess I thought the siblings had this ESP thing that you could read my mind.
Yeah.
But I wish I had expressed that to you a long time ago.
Well, thank you. And I don't hold anything. I don't hold it against you though, because you were doing what you were told to do. Really? And I mean, even now in present day, just recently I was reading about a talk given by one of the general authorities saying in so much that, you know, like if you love your homosexual family member or friend and you fully accept them 100%, then you're not really living the gospel. You're not on the Lord's side. So, and you know, even now that's being taught, even though the church is relaxed in so many ways, that's still, I read about it, it's still out there. Mm-hmm. Just last week.
So you and your ex-wife worked it out where you had custody of your daughter.
Right.
It was a mutual agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And you dated some men, which made me very uncomfortable.
I mean, it made everyone uncomfortable.
Including
me. Because there were some real
armpit smellers out there.
Oh, can't believe I told you about that.
We won't share that.
Let's just say my dating experience
involves
was very disappointing. I was like, yay, finally, freedom. I can go out and enjoy. And there was not a lot of enjoyment because everyone seemed like such a loser. I just had really bad luck. I'm not to say that they're all losers, but that was everyone that I met was just such a turnoff, and not physically necessarily, but just because they just seemed like such losers, you know, and I didn't want that. I wanted somebody who was established and stable and that wanted a family and that would eventually accept my daughters. And well, that's what I got eventually. Well,
but then you did it the way that if I had known you were doing this, I would have said, don't do it. Did you answer a personal ad or you put out a personal ad?
I answered.
He answered a personal ad.
Right. And that, of course, was before the internet.
Single white male.
And yeah, I mean, I didn't know. I lived in suburbia and there was not a gay bar for miles around. And I didn't know a single other gay person. I couldn't remember ever having met a gay person that I knew about. Well, no, there was one person that we worked with and he was so super flamboyant
everyone knew he was gay.
Yeah. And that wasn't really the brand of gay that I was attracted to or that I wanted to be necessarily. So, other than him, that was it. So, yeah, I looked in the LA Weekly personals and Men Seeking Men, because I was just so desperate to like meet somebody. And yeah, there were a lot of guys that were only interested in one thing and a lot of guys that were super losers. And that sounds so awful of me to say super losers, but they were just at the time I was like, yeah, they're such losers because they, you know, they didn't have a job or they didn't really seem to be going in any particular direction. And I was just like so past all that. I was established. I had a family and I couldn't waste time with guys like that. So anyway.
But then, surprisingly, you met a wonderful man.
I did. I had given up on the personals. I was like, you know, forget this. This is ridiculous. I'm just going to have to stop thinking about it and just live my life. And, you know, eventually something will come along, hopefully. I kind of was in despair, though. I thought, oh, I'll never meet anybody. So there was this last personal ad that I came across that I decided, okay, I'll give this one more shot. But it was the way the ad was worded. It was very interesting to me because it just said something like along the lines of sincerity, friendship, and respect or something along those lines. And then underneath it, it just said something about wanting to make a friend that, you know, can have a nice time with and mutual respect and maybe something more, but not necessarily. So that sounded good to me. So I called and we ended up talking on the phone for a few weeks. And then we finally decided to meet and, we hit it off really like almost immediately. He was established. He was smart. He was good looking. He was smart, quote unquote, my type. And he loved kids. And he was also a teacher and he just seemed like perfect. He didn't live too far away. He had his own home. He was just like, I thought he was the best thing ever. So within a few months, we had kind of committed to each other. And then the next year we bought a house together and he jumped in with both feet as far as, being a father to our daughters. And it was great. He was like a dream come true. I remember so many times looking at him and talking with him and just thinking, I can't believe this actually happened.
Well, and from our perspective, from the, you know, the Mormon family, he's the type of person that you easy to talk to. We were never uncomfortable with him.
No, he's very good in a conversation.
Very great guy.
Yeah.
Willing to take our craziness and just accept it. And
yeah. Well, it took him a little while to accept some of them.
Well.
But.
It takes us a little while to accept them ourselves. So. No kidding. I was relieved that the person you were with was someone I liked, because if it was someone I didn't like, I think it would have caused more issues with your homosexuality for us.
See that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It would have been harder for you to get past the whole gay thing if I was with somebody that you didn't like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was good. We didn't discuss you were called into church court.
Oh yeah. That's kind of important.
Was this before or after you met him?
Before.
Before?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened with that?
My ex-wife, she was just having a regular bishop's interview or something. And at some point the topic of me came up and she defended me. She was very concerned about how I was going to be treated. And, she disagreed with the church's stance on homosexuality anyway. And she voiced her opinion on that matter. And so.
Was this the same bishop that you had told?
No, this was a different bishop. We had moved to a different ward.
And do you know if he had any information from the other bishop?
I don't think so, because there was a long period of time where we just, you know, after she came back, after the earthquake, we just slipped very seamlessly into our ward, and we loved the ward, and California ward was way different from the Utah wards that we'd experienced, and we really enjoyed it. And so, you know, we got callings and it was great. We enjoyed it a lot. So I think that, I don't think anybody had a clue really until she and I actually decided to split up, and then rumors started to fly in.
So you were called in, your ex-wife was called in, mm-hmm. and then you were called in. I guess by then you knew what it was about. Why you were being called in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Throughout our whole separation and divorce, my ex was very, very supportive of me. the whole way. And, that was wonderful. That made things so much easier for me and so much better for our family, I think. I know. And then, word got out that rumor got out that I was gay and that she and I weren't together anymore. And so that's when I received a letter and I was called in by the stake president for disciplinary counsel, and I refused to go. And, together we wrote a long letter outlining my feelings, our feelings, and I talked a lot about why I didn't want to go, because I felt like in a sense, my entire life had been a church court and I was tired of that and I was ready to move on. I did not want to participate in it anymore. I was done with being treated that way and feeling that way. So, I didn't go. And a few weeks later, I got a letter in the mail saying it was done, that I had been excommunicated.
Didn't you tell me in that 11-page letter you offered to resign?
Yes. Before I went into the disciplinary council, I had started to talk to other people who had left the church that weren't necessarily gay, but had left the church for other reasons, and they talked me through how to maybe go about just having my name removed instead of having to go through the whole trauma of church disciplinary council and excommunication. So in the letter, yes, I did state that I would like to have my name removed. And then in the reply, the stake presidency said, nope, sorry, too late. We can't do that, but we will excommunicate you. You know, it was kind of like, no, you can't leave, but we'll kick you out.
It's just a power play.
Yeah.
It's just control.
Right. So.
So ridiculous.
So I didn't go. I didn't buy into it so much. And then it was over. And while the whole process is traumatic in nature, and anybody who's gone through it can attest to that, but I was so relieved once it was finally done. I was done with the church and I was out of the closet, and I had finally been honest with my wife and honest with myself and honest with anybody who I knew closely. And it was such an amazing feeling. It was like no other feeling. It was great. So I was very, very happy, and it was definitely the right move to make finally.
Did you believe in the church anymore, in the truthfulness?
Oh, well, you know, it's so all or nothing. So, I would say to myself, well, if the church says that homosexuality is wrong and that I'm equal to murderers and child molesters, then if they say that, I know that's not true. So then the rest of it must not be true either. But then I'd say, but no, there are bits and pieces of this that I do still think that I still agree with. So I was just like so confused about what to believe anymore that I just threw it all out. I said, I have to start over. And since then I've heard other people say that. But for me, I didn't know really, aside from those few conversations that I'd had with people, about how to maybe have my name removed from the church, I didn't talk to people about how they felt during the process and afterward. So, I was kind of relieved and kind of surprised to learn later that, oh, a lot of people did that. When they left the church, they didn't know what to believe anymore. So they had to just like start all over. So I kind of, you know, it was sort of my mantra in my head that I don't know what I believe, but I do believe in honesty and kindness. And so that was my new religion.
Do you remember that conversation we had on the phone where I like mentioned something? Cause in my head, I knew you didn't believe in the church anymore, but I thought, well, he believes in Christ. He believes in God. And I mentioned that to you. You're like, I don't know there's a God. There might be, but I don't know. You were just instantly very defensive.
I was.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember. I do remember. I do remember you asking me, well, you still believe in Christ, right?
And I was just so shocked. Like, how can a kind person
not believe
in Christ?
In Christ. Yeah.
So,
and not that I said that I didn't.
No.
I never said, no, I don't believe
in
God. I don't believe
in
Jesus.
You just said, I do not know.
I don't know. I pretty soon got to the point where I was calling myself an agnostic after that.
This is your story, but let me just give my viewpoint again. Through my faith transition, one of my biggest regrets is that it's such a weird cyclical thing you do in your head, because even though I never once believed that you were a bad person or any homosexual would be, unless they are awful people, I still just kept silent. Like, I just, well, the church will take care of it, or when we die. And I would hear these awful, terrible things. And sometimes I'd even look around the Relief Society room, wherever it was, and like, looking for anyone else to be shocked like me. And I never saw any of it. Mm-hmm. And I just regret not speaking up. Yeah. Because I just never realized that what was happening was hate.
Right.
Just pure hate. And that we were being taught that was okay. And I really regret that, as something that it took my loss of faith to decide that it was really wrong. And I should have just stood up for you from the very beginning.
Well,
I'm still a coward sometimes.
I'm just glad that you were able to get there.
And how many years did it take?
That's okay.
Anyways, so you met a man. He's a manly man. No. You met a man. You built a great life together, and you decided that you would like to have another baby.
Right. So when we'd been together for a few years, we adopted a son. And we adopted him as a newborn, and he's 10 years old now.
He's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yes, he is.
And we're glad he's here. And I guess the rest is history. Oh, the law changed, and you decided to make your lover an honest man.
Lover.
And you were married.
We were. After we'd been together for about 5 years, this was before same-sex marriage was legal in California at all. We had a commitment ceremony. Domestic partnership had been put in place by that point. So we were registered domestic partners, and that, covered us in many, many ways, and that was great. But it still wasn't marriage. And then a few years after that, suddenly, same-sex marriage in California was legal. And so I think it was a window of about 8 months that it was legal. And so after watching on TV all of these couples in California getting married, we decided that we should participate in the cause as well and show our support, because we already felt like we were married. I didn't feel the need to get married so I could change my life, because in my head and in his head, we were already there.
Well, so much so you didn't even tell anyone you were doing it.
Oh, right.
Except
true.
Me. You told me.
I did.
Yeah. You called me I think the night before.
Right before.
Like, oh yeah, we're going to go get married tomorrow.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You were the only one then, because nobody else knew. And so we went, and just the two of us, and we went to a park in West Hollywood and
wearing shorts and t-shirts.
No.
Yeah, you were.
We weren't wearing shorts
and
t-shirts.
You weren't dressed up.
We were kind of dressed up.
No,
we had
weren't.
Like dress pants and a nicer short sleeve collared shirt, because it was like 110 degrees that day, but.
I don't know. We're going to have to look at those pictures again.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. I have proof. And yeah, we got married. And then we went home and told his mom, and she flipped her lid.
In a good way?
Not in a bad way, but she got over it pretty quickly.
Okay.
Because when we said, no, we already feel like we've been married and we had everyone there that we loved.
Oh, she wanted to be there.
Yeah.
Oh, you meant she was upset.
No, not like, in a negative weird. Way. No. Okay. She wanted to be there.
Oh, okay.
So, you kind of understand that. So then soon after that, boom, it's not legal anymore. Voters decided it wasn't legal. So, and then along came Prop 8, and that was living in the middle of Prop 8, in my town where I had lived for so many years, and I had worked, and I had taught in that town, and I had gone through my adjustment as far as getting used to my homosexual life and being married and everything. All of a sudden, Prop 8 was in my face, everywhere I turned. On every corner, there were my former ward members standing with those big banners, and it was just everywhere. And that threw me for a huge loop. That was really hard to work through, and took me a long time to get over that. And now again, of course, same-sex marriage in California is legal again. Thank you to the Supreme Court.
And people that fought hard for it?
Yeah, lots, yes. And knowing and hearing and reading that Prop 8 was so fully funded, so much funded by the church.
Which was kept a secret even from ward members.
Yes.
I didn't know about that until recently.
They didn't know about the funding, but ward members sure knew about the signs, where to get the picket signs.
Well, that was kept, at least from my little perspective, it was kept pretty quiet too.
I wasn't in
California.
Right. In Utah, the Utahns didn't know the Californians were.
So yeah. It was not common knowledge that signs were being passed out in church parking lots and that they were being asked to do it by bishops
and announced over the pulpit.
Yeah, announced over the pulpit. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So that was disturbing.
And that was when I really my fears that I felt about you and our siblings and all the other people that were still in the church that I loved, that's when they all really came to a head. And that's when, I wrote that blog post.
Yeah. And I do know, even though I still was in my little cocoon, I do know if I'd been in California, I would not have stood on the corner with a picket sign. I keep quiet because I'm a coward, very much so, but at least I know that little small line I would have drawn
because that's,
I guess, somewhere deep down I knew that it was wrong.
Yeah.
But that was hard. That was very hard for you, and that's when I realized your worlds were colliding. There was a picture of the temple with a man climbing on the...
I was a woman, actually.
Oh, sorry. an androgynous... Sorry. There was a very handsome individual climbing on the fence of the temple, waving a rainbow flag.
Yeah.
And that was hard for me. Not nearly what it was for you, but it was hard to see.
Yeah.
And that leads us to today.
And here we are, all these years later.
In the Mormon Expression Studio. Never would have guessed this would happen.
No. Nope, but I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you. All right, so there is part two. Thanks for coming on, Jason.
Thank you.
And if you would also like to share your story on Mormon Expression Voices, go ahead and email me at voices@mormonexpression.com. Have a good day. Bye.